if you have $30,000 or $40,000 in your bank account, I think you can absolutely get started in real estate. I know a ton of people who get started with way less. And I would look for a cheap value add property that you can put some sweat equity into. If you're a newbie, start with a cosmetic rehab. Look for that orange shag carpet and the pink painted kitchen and the oak cabinets.
You're listening to the Next Generation Podcast, weekly interviews with the most interesting and successful 20-somethings out there.
On today's podcast episode, we have Grace Gudenkauf from Good Morning Investments. Thanks for coming on the show, Grace.
Thank you for having me.
So Grace has managed to go from a mechanical engineer to full-time investor, which is kind of sounds probably like a pretty interesting story. Would you be able to give us kind of a brief overview on what that journey looked like and where you're currently at right now?
Yes, I'm a 24-year-old investor from Iowa. I started as a mechanical engineer. I only did that for about a year. And then I took the leap full-time into investing, kind of accidental. We'll get into that later. But right now I have, I think, 18 units, and we do a little bit of everything, midterm rentals, rehabs, turnkey, you name it. We're all over the place, but it's been a lot of fun.
So how does somebody accidentally get into real estate? It's like you wake up one morning, you're like, oh, shit, I'm in a duplex now.
Yeah, I guess I shouldn't say accidentally, but like with my job, I was kind of forced to make the decision. It wasn't like I was like, oh my gosh, today's the day. My job was actually based out of California, San Diego, California, and I was working remotely from Iowa, and I was going to have to move back out there. And that's kind of what forced me to come to terms with, am I going to do this or not? And I knew if I went back to California that I would definitely just not be able to accomplish as much as I could in Iowa due to just not knowing as many people and the crazy, crazy prices. So that's what made me be like, all right, I'm just going to try it.
Did you have real estate kind of on your list beforehand, or, you know, did it just happen that you were trying to figure out a way to make some additional side money?
I was only like 6 months into doing real estate when I decided to quit my job, but how I got started in real estate in general was my boyfriend actually flipped a house when I was still in college. So I saw him do that and I was like, oh, that's a really good idea. I'll definitely do that at some point. But it didn't occur to me that it would be like soon or that it was on the horizon. And then when I was in Iowa over the winter of 2021, we were like, okay, let's get a house. It's Iowa. There's going to be nothing to do. So I'm ready to work my ass off, like make some money. And that's how it started. And I never could have imagined that like just getting that one house would have led to so many other things.
So walk us through the numbers on your first project, because I feel like it kind of sounds like, at least from somebody who's listening to this right now, who has never done a real estate deal, they see these housing prices. They're like $300,000, $500,000, $800,000. They're like, holy shit, like I don't have that much money saved up. And not only that, but like between the legal stuff, you know, like the technical things behind like getting like a title report, getting appraisal, like all that kind of stuff. Like it seems outrageously complicated. So I'd love to kind of know what the process looked like for that first house and what the numbers looked like and what your upside was.
Yeah. So the numbers, we bought it for $82,000. It was like a 1600 square foot house. It was a huge house. I mean, it's Iowa. It's very, very affordable. That was another, like I said, a huge reason why I didn't want to go to California. And then we fixed it up for $35,000 and it appraised for $185,000. So we actually kept that house and refinanced it to pull out all of our capital and do it again. And it ended up cash flowing. I think the cash flow is around $350, give or take a little bit. So that was an awesome deal. Granted, we did DIY it. So we had a hell of a 6 months doing that every day. And it was a gross property. So it was not fun. But looking back on it, it's like, yeah, that was amazing. But while we were doing it, it was so not fun.
Oh my God. It's so funny you say that, because we were just having this conversation the other day about how like the shitty things you do and like the unfortunate like, hard work always seems so miserable at the time. And you look back and you're like, that was actually the most fun part. But it never feels that way during the time. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just quickly clarify on two things for anyone listening right now. So you bought it for $85,000. So one, did you pay all cash for that acquisition? And two, when you said that you refinance, I think, you know, if you're in real estate, you're you're familiar with what that term means, but for anyone not, can you kind of explain how that whole process works?
Yes. So we did not pay all cash. We did not have the money to, we did not have $85,000. We had money to do the rehab, but we had to put a 20% down bank loan on it to get it, to get the property. So that ended up being like a $16,000 down payment. And then we had the $35,000 in rehab. So that was all the cash we had. We couldn't do anything else. We couldn't hire it out. We didn't have the money. We had to DIY, which ended up being a blessing in disguise because we learned so much, saved a ton of money, and did a great deal. And then secondly, the refinance piece, that's essentially where you go and you say, hey, bank, my house is now worth so much more. So why don't you loan me on what it's now worth? And they say, okay, sure, we'll give you 80% or 70% of what it's now worth. And they give you that cash and you pay yourself back everything you've already had into it. So you really, it's a way for you to get your capital back out of the deal.
And to clarify, they're really valuing the property based on the rental income, correct?
If it's a multifamily or commercial property, yes. If it's a single family, like your regular house, they're going to evaluate it on what a homeowner would pay for it. So you're going to go and get an appraisal and they're going to look at comparable properties and see what those sell for. But yeah, if it's multifamily or commercial, it's all about the numbers.
And then how did you find this property? And maybe how has that transitioned once you've done your first deal and now, you know, deals down the road? Are you cold calling sellers? You working with brokers? What does that look like?
I actually buy all my properties off market. Another huge advantage to investing where I grew up in Iowa, is that I just have connections and I know people, and all of my deals have been so different of just, I know someone who knew, whose banker is selling a house or my uncle's friend or whatever. But this house actually I saw for rent sign and I called it off a whim, and I could tell that he was an investor because he didn't know what he couldn't explain about the house. Like he couldn't remember which house it was. So I was like, wait, do you have multiple properties? Are you an investor? And he ended up sending me a list of all of his houses. And me and my boyfriend said, let us see your grossest one. And so we went and toured it. And then that's how we ended up with this property, because we knew we wanted a value add property, yeah, get some sweat equity, and really force the value of the house to increase.
Do you have specific strategies you recommend for someone looking to find their first house? Is it really the best option to go for something off market or to work with a broker? Or how would you suggest someone that's never done that before?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it just depends on what you want to do. You can get probably better deals off market, but it's going to be a lot more work because you don't have anybody on your team working for you. And you're going to have to figure out how the heck to buy a house and how the transaction works. When I bought this house, I had no clue how to buy a house, but I Google searched everything as it came up and I figured it out and we bought it. Where on the other hand, if you want to pay maybe a little bit more and buy on the MLS with a realtor, that could be a fantastic option. They're going to do the work for you. They're going to find you the houses. They're going to be shifting all the leads your way. So it's just really, what do you want? Do you want to do a little bit more work and hopefully get a better deal? Or do you want to take maybe a little bit of an easier way, maybe pay a little bit more, but somebody is doing a lot of that work for you? So there's no right answer.
That's actually probably a great transition point to kind of diving to my next question of what were some of the mistakes or things that you did in that first deal that looking like, is it like to your point? Yeah. You know, nobody knows how to close a house until they close a house. And so what were some of the mistakes and things that you did during like those first 6 months that looking back now that you've had, you know, 18 properties under your belt, you're like, oh no. Like there's a way easier way to do that. And I could have saved a ton of time and headache.
One thing that comes straight to my mind is my negotiation skills were horrible. There was a bunch of stuff that came up during that inspection and I was like so nervous to ask and like try to negotiate with the guy, and we probably could have got it for a lot cheaper, but it sounded like being a great deal. But other than that, I think I've just learned how to market a lot better. I use Facebook a ton for, I have like a Good Morning Investments Facebook page, and I really am interactive with my audience there so that they're bringing me deals. I tell everybody I'll give $1,000 to anybody who even just gives me an address that I close on. And I've paid that out, I think, 3 times, which has been awesome. and maybe just paying for software and paying for team, like paying to build a team and put people in their right places, is something that I didn't realize at first. Looking back on it, it's always better to just pay someone to do the job right, for sure.
What does a team on an organization like this look like? And maybe your first hire and second hire, and when those make sense to actually do?
Yeah, so some of the key people in a rental business are going to be your handyman, your cleaner, your property manager, if you choose to hire that out. Right now, I unfortunately don't, and that's me. Any contractors, your insurance agent, your banker, all of those key players that are going to help you build your business. And I also actually, within the last 6 months, hired an acquisitionist. So I have somebody who helps me finding those off-market deals, and I pay them commission-based. So for me, that was my first hire. So that was a big step in my business as well.
What's that role look like? Are they literally just cold calling every single property, or like following up with everything on the MLS?
No, we don't really do cold calling, but yeah, definitely combing Facebook, Craigslist, Zillow, maybe a little bit of direct mail, maybe a little bit of here and there. But Facebook is a big one for sure.
And how do you comp on that? Is it like, hey, if you buy something, you know, find something is $100,000, we'll pay you 5%, or what does that look like?
Yep. We pay them, commission based on the purchase price. So for us, we do 1% of the purchase price. So if you get me a $100,000 house, I will pay you $1,000. And they're just getting the warm lead for me. I'm the one that's actually closing and doing the closing call and closing on the house.
In terms of the resources on, you know, getting up to speed with a lot of this stuff, I think on your Instagram, you do talk a bit about kind of Bigger Pockets and some books and, you know, things that can help people get informed. Is there anything specifically that really sticks out as being a huge lever on letting you kind of grow and get some of those first deals under your belt?
Absolutely. When I was only like 3 months into real estate, I decided to enroll in a mentorship that was $5,000, which is a lot of money. And that exponentially grew my business. That was a big risk, a big leap of faith. A lot of people probably couldn't imagine spending $5,000 on a mentorship, but for me, that was huge. I learned how to do creative financing, which is a whole nother world. And just having that person who is rooting for you and keeping you accountable has been massive. So I think that if you're looking to get started, I'm all about paying to take the elevator up. You don't have to bootstrap everything and figure it out all on your own. In fact, that's not an efficient or smart way to do it. Pay for the right people, pay for the right resources, and you can 10 times your business.
What are some of the things that you got out of the mentorship? I'm assuming it's things that are just as simple as like, you know, you write down the problems you're having during the week and you can just like talk through it and things like that. But like, were there specific things you got out?
Yeah, that as well as creative financing in general. That was the main topic of the mentorship, is learning how to buy sub 2 rent mortgages, seller financing, and all that good stuff. And they helped me set up my acquisitionist as well.
And is that what you do for most of your properties now? Is it like you'll go in, you'll say, hey, listen, you guys seller finance 30% of this, we'll get a loan on the rest. But how do you structure a lot of those?
I actually kind of have like two sides to my business. Mm-hmm. One is the creative side. And when I buy those creative deals, I'll either wholesale it or rent to own it. And then I have like my long-term rentals and medium-term rentals. So those are kind of my two separate sides. So my acquisitionist is helping with the creative side. But yeah, there's a certain way to approach it and kind of a right way to make it seem like it's the seller's idea and get them sold on that.
Could you maybe dive into that a little bit more on how you can actually get that conversation going and maybe what some of the different options are with creative financing?
Yeah. So creative financing, some of the main is basically a realm of strategies. And some of the strategies are a wrap mortgage, sub two, lease sandwich, seller financing, novation agreements. Those are all different types of creative financing. And it's basically how you acquire the property. You acquire it via seller financing. And so really the number one gist with creative financing is listening to what the seller wants and needs, because more than likely it's way deeper than I need to sell my house. Are they moving? Did somebody die? Are they behind on their rent, on their mortgage? Are they upside down on their mortgage, all these different things, and then figuring out how you can solve those issues with a creative solution.
Is there a maybe specifically a Bigger Pockets book or some other resource that specifically discusses some of the creative financing aspects? Because I think there's a lot of, you know, younger people probably our age that have the hustle and the kind of the drive to go out and find these deals, but probably don't have the financing or the money on the back end to actually pursue the deal.
Yeah, I feel like even like a one pager of like, what is the lease sandwich? I'm just like thinking to myself, I was like, I can't, like, okay, does that, are you paying for the lease or what are you doing here?
Going to Subway?
Yeah. No, a lease sandwich is basically when you just start leasing it and lease it back with an option agreement to buy it down the line. But there's really not a lot of great resources, unfortunately. And that's why I paid for this mentorship, because there aren't really any books. There aren't really any blogs or podcasts or anything. So maybe I'll write one. Yeah, there's not really a ton of resources out there, but I think probably YouTube videos is where you would find. You can probably search RAP, Sub2, seller financing, and find a bunch of info there.
In terms of that mentorship you keep bringing up, was this something you actively pursued? Was it someone local? Or, you know, if I decide, hey, I'm going to go down the mentorship route, how can I make sure I find someone that, you know, it gets really expensive? Yeah. How do I make sure I'm actually paying the right person to teach me some of this stuff?
Such a good point. I've never met this couple. I've been mentoring with them now for almost an entire year. I think next month is 1 year. I've never met them. I've only met them over in Zoom. They're in New York. And I think when it comes to making sure that you're getting your money out of it, it's having a lot of those expectations and conversations up front before you decide to do it, laying out exactly what does this consist of? What are you providing me? What are the boundaries? And hashing all that out. So I knew in my head what I wanted. And we had a call and it seemed like a good fit. So I went for it. And then I did that for 6 months and then I renewed it and did it again.
That's awesome. It seems to be a really big theme across a lot of the people that we interview is like just jumping ahead. I feel like even like from this podcast standpoint, like that's kind of the goal with this podcast is like giving people the information that they need earlier than when they would typically have access to it.
Yeah.
I feel like with the mentor side of things, that's super valuable because you're getting that 20, 30 years of experience.
Exactly. Yes, you're getting everything they learned, all the mistakes they did, all the things they fucked up, and they're telling you, yes, you have to pay for it, but you didn't have to learn those mistakes. You didn't have to pay for the mistakes. Right. They did.
Yeah. If anything, you could be saving like the $5,000 sounds like a lot of money, but like a $50,000 mistake on an investment is a whole lot more money.
Yeah. In the real estate world, $5,000, that's reflooring a kitchen. That's nothing. That's like, you spend $5,000 like that and fixing up a house.
I'm going to start referring to money in that sense for like everything. You know, it's like Gio and I are going to go like skiing for the weekend. It's like, yeah, man, but that's like a new door with a storage facility. We own. Like, I don't know. But I think like, so now, like I totally hear you on the mentor piece. And I completely agree. The next thing I kind of want to dive into is when you first bought that first $85,000 house, what year was that?
2021.
Okay, so you went from 0 to 18 properties in a year and a half?
A year,
damn, okay.
Yeah.
So what I'd love to know now is out of these 18 properties that you own, what do they look like in terms of, you know, are you house hacking two of them? Well, I guess you can't really be doing two at the same time, but are you house hacking one? Are you doing like single family? Are you doing those midterm rentals, which I think is a really interesting topic I want to dive into.
Yeah, so I guess I should clarify. I think I have 18 units.
Okay.
And then 8 properties. And I also have my house, which I do house hack, but I'm not really counting that. I just live with my boyfriend and my sister. But of the 18, we have 1 8 unit, which we use midterm rentals. I have 2 duplexes, which are one's midterm rentals, the other 3 are long-term tenants. And then we have, 6 other single families, which I do some long-term rentals and some rent to own, because I said I kind of have those two pieces of my business. And then I also sublease a unit and then put it on a midterm rental. And then I also have a unit that we will probably do that with in a different market with a partner that we kind of randomly decided to do a creative deal with. But yeah, so right now within the long-term rentals and midterm rentals, I have 4 or 5 midterm rentals, and that's been super awesome. It's a really great way to make a lot more cash flow. It is a little bit more work, but I think it's super smart. If there's a need for your area, you could be the only person maybe that provides that, and you're going to get bombarded with people who need that type of housing.
What does your current cash flow look like, maybe from a growth standpoint and then a free cash flow, maybe after you're paid off all your debt and, you know, what you have left over at the end of the month?
Yeah, so I honestly don't know the answer. I was just thinking to me, I need to calculate that today. But I can talk on like a per unit standpoint. Sure. Per unit, if it's a single family, I want at least $300 per door. If it's a—
is that after you pay the debt off or before? What is that $300
actually look like? That's pure cash flow. So after I've paid my debt and I've saved 15% for CapEx, repairs, and vacancies. So that's like what I can literally take in my pocket if I want to. But yeah, at least $300. That's probably on the low end. For my multifamily units, I want $200 a door, but if I'm doing midterm rentals, I want $500 a door. And all of my multifamily units, I will eventually turn into midterm rentals.
Could you— probably a good time to maybe dive into that a little bit specifically, you know, what is a midterm rental? How are you finding comps and underwriting it and filling it up? And what does that even look like?
Yeah, so midterm rental is really just furnishing a rental and letting people rent it on a month-to-month basis. So on the scale of long-term rental to short-term rental, it's actually a lot closer to the long-term rental, and the fact that you're not trying to provide that five-star Airbnb experience. You're really just furnishing a unit and saying, sure, you can rent this for just 3 months at a time. And you're targeting traveling professionals more than likely. With COVID, travel nursing has absolutely boomed, and those people are looking for 90-day furnished days with Wi-Fi and utilities, and they're willing to pay a lot of money for it. And I started with— we bought an 8-unit and it had 1 empty unit. So I said, okay, this is a great chance to try it out. If it doesn't work, I'm only out the $2,000 I spent furnishing it. And I think I underwrote it that it would rent for $800 a month. On long-term rental, it was $525. I now am at like $1,000 for those units. So I want to be like super, super conservative when I'm doing that underwriting, because it is hard to find comps. It is hard to know what you're going to make. So I always preach under promise and over deliver to yourself, to your investors, to your team. So I put $800. Now I'm renting them for $1,000. I could probably rent them for $1,100. And then a 2-bed, 1 bath. Long-term rental is $600, and those will go for $1,400 as a midterm rental. Granted, you're picking up Wi-Fi, you're picking up all the utilities. That could be a couple $100 in just utilities. Wi-Fi is probably $50. You're also going to have more cleaning fees, because you're probably going to have 4 tenants a year instead of 1 tenant a year. You're going to have higher vacancy because you might have a couple weeks between those tenants. So it's not like you're just doubling your cash flow. You're doubling the rent, but you're also picking up more expenses. But it's still a really great way to up your cash flow.
How far are y'all from the hospital for that $8?
Like a mile, two okay. miles.
And was that— I'm assuming that was pretty intentional when you found the place. You were like, this is the perfect spot.
Yes. I think that if you're going to do it, you need to be close to a hospital. But if you are in a smaller town and you're the only one who's going to offer it, you can probably be in not an ideal location and people will want it. My town's only 120,000 people. So it was hard for me to know, like, okay, is this going to work? Like, do people even do this? But I went to Furnish Finders. It's a website that like hosts midterm rentals for travel nurses. That's literally what it's for. And I just looked and I saw there wasn't a ton of stuff out there. Mm-hmm. So I went for it. Another thing you could do is pay the $100 to list on Furnish Finder, list a fake ad. And if no one replies to it, you're out $100, and you know that that's not a good idea. If you get bombarded, you're like, holy shit, I better buy something ASAP and furnish it and get it on this website so I can make a bunch of money.
That's a great idea. Yeah, I was gonna say, it's so funny because coming from an e-commerce background too, there's like the age old experiment of you'll run like a product ad, and based on the cost you're getting per click on Facebook, and the conversion rate that you can theoretically get on your website, then you can validate it and be like, cool, now I'm going to go drop the 10 or 20 grand to go and actually like buy the inventory for this product. Is Furnish Finder like the number one source of leads that you're getting for specifically for travel nurses, or are there other platforms as well?
I just use Furnish Finder and I get bombarded.
That's amazing. Wow.
Are you actively looking at housing and new acquisitions around the same hospital? Are you looking at other hospitals? This is kind of the main focus of your strategy?
Like for the next place that we want to buy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would love to buy again in Cedar Rapids. For me, I think that I'm probably going to outgrow that market sooner or later. So I'm starting to look elsewhere.
Very cool. In terms of like, I feel like people hear real estate episodes either on this podcast or on Bigger Pockets or whatever. And, you know, the headlines always sound great, right? Like 0 to 18 doors in 1 year and passive income and all that kind of stuff. But what they don't often hear about are the unsexy sides of this business and some of the shit that has to go into it to actually get there. I'd love to kind of hear maybe some of the, I don't know, frustrations or...
I got so many.
Yeah, okay. Well, so let's
I can dish it out.
What are some of like the less sexy sides of this business that you maybe say, make sure you're at least aware that this is probably going to happen before you go and start buying a bunch of single family and eightplexes in Iowa?
Yeah, I think like for me personally, two super unsexy things about my life is, first of all, my business is my boyfriend and I, and we have taken very little money from our actual business. It all sits in that bank account and gets used to buy the next property. So yeah, I might be cash flowing $5,000 a month, but I don't see that because I'm using that money to buy the next one. So like, that's the first thing is you're probably not going to earn, like take that money out right away. And it's going to take a while to build it up. The second thing is like, when I quit my job, I knew like I live like a broke college kid still. I can be okay. I don't have a ton of lifestyle creep to support. So I'm okay with the lower income. I literally drive my mom's old 2006 or 2007 minivan because I don't give a shit. And I would not trade that for a 9-to-5 job. I'm not gonna go work a 9-to-5 job just so I can drive a cooler car. Like for me, I will drive the super unsexy car and do whatever I want all day. And like, for example, today I came to visit my friend in Des Moines and we're co-working all day because I can't. And yeah, I had to drive my minivan up here. It wasn't fun, but I will do it. And so it's just things like that, sacrifices that you don't see people advertising all over the place. For me, I was definitely stressful a few months into quitting my job. I was like, oh crap, like I need to get something going here. And it took probably 4 or 5 months before I was like, okay, I'm in a good spot. We're making good income. We've got our properties up and running. We feel good, but yeah, there's so much unsexy stuff that doesn't get showcased, that really needs to be.
And do you think when you quit your job, looking back on it now, that it was still the right time to go and quit? Or do you think in hindsight, you would have maybe wanted to hold on for another 4 to 5 months, get a few more properties and income under your belt to maybe alleviate some of that stress you might have had early on?
I think it was the right time for me because I think that the longer I would have worked my job, the more money I would have made, the more responsibilities I would have had in my personal life, like maybe a bigger house, a car payment, kids, pets, like supporting all those things where I didn't have any of those bills. So I was like, oh, I can quit my job. I only have to care about me. If there were other people in the picture, that'd be so much harder. Not to mention the longer I work my job, the more I'm going to make, the harder it's going to be to walk away. And for me,
all handcuffs.
Exactly. As well as it's been 8 months now. And there's so many projects and opportunities I've gotten to work on that I never would have dreamt of 8 months ago because I didn't have the time.
That's amazing.
And so there's so many things you won't even realize could happen or will be an opportunity that once you do have the time and the energy, like your world is gonna just really open up.
And can you kind of explain to me as well, like, I feel like I completely hear you when you say like, we make $5,000 in net income per month, but like all of that's going back towards buying new properties, towards paying your acquisition person, to like managing your team. Is there a certain number that you have in mind when one day you'll have this coming in every single month where you're like, okay, cool, I'll be able to like take my foot off the gas a little bit and actually like pay myself, maybe go to some nice dinners or like whatever. Like do you have a number in mind of what you're going for? Is it like, nope, just snowball this thing up for the next 20 years and live frugally as hell, but then like build, like own half of Iowa?
Well, that's so funny you say that, because every month I'm like to my boyfriend Brant, I'm gonna pay us this month, but then I never actually get around to writing the check, because I just am like, I'll do it next month. I don't want to do the bookkeeping to figure it out. But I think soon, definitely soon, we'll start paying ourselves, and I would like to hit 20k a month passive income and then be like, I'm doing whatever I want. Like, oh, I'm out, I'm gonna go live on a boat, I'm not gonna work maybe 5 to 10 hours online, something that I really like, but like, yeah, no more gas, just cruise control.
Are you that kind of person that can just like turn it off? Because I feel like I hear that from so many people. Like, the fact is, you're 24 years old, you already own 18 doors, right? And so like, people who are typically at that type of ambition level and like to go and start things and hustle, I have found, I'll speak for myself personally, so to not like impose anything on you, I have a very tough time turning off. Even if I go and like screw off to some random vacation spot for like a month or whatever like that, like I literally cannot stop working. And not to say I fully can't stop working, but like, it's always on the back of my mind.
Always.
Do you think that you're the kind of person that can just like, oh, cool, I got 20K coming in, like going to the Bahamas and like, that's it for the next couple of weeks?
Maybe for like a week or two, but yeah, I went to Hawaii in November and I was literally so bored. I was like, I can't sit here in the sun one more day. I want to work on something. Where's my computer? Like, I'm so 100 miles an hour in my mind. Yeah.
It's a blessing and a curse.
Oh, for sure. So I think that I'll definitely like at that 20K mark, know that I don't have to, and then I can enjoy that money and that freedom, but I'm sure there will be a million other projects that I want to take on.
Are you looking into any other kind of asset classes, maybe once you hit that mark, or any other businesses at all? Or is it mostly kind of real estate? You're going to stick with this until you've scaled out as far as possible.
Within real estate, I'm open to anything, but I'm also like, I know I'm 100 miles per hour and I know I need to stick to like a few things and be good at them instead of having my hand in every single pot. Like, I literally listened to a Bigger Pockets episode on the way here about an RV park, and I texted my sisters, let's buy an RV park. Like, I'm so ridiculous. But I need to stick, I think, to like multifamily and single family. If there's a right opportunity, I'm down for anything. But outside of real estate, I would love to get into buying small businesses.
Very cool. And so two things there, actually. One, I was going to say, the last podcast that we did that I was kind of alluding to earlier with Chris Powers, he made a whole comment where, you know, I think he graduated college at like 22 and had like already like 17 or 20 or something like that units. And now he's in this position where he's like 36 and runs like $700 million in assets under management, like crazy shit. But he was saying how the biggest shift in his career came when he was finally started turning down the single family residentials, finally started started turning down, you know, the RV parks of the world, and only focused on Class B industrials in Dallas. And this is something that Gio and I go back and forth on a ton. It's like, we think if you focus on one asset class, you can probably get outsized returns because you can underwrite it quicker than anyone else. You know exactly the value add opportunities there, and you're super focused and can build a team around it. But the contrary to that is that it could also probably be a little bit more fun if you dabble around and jump around a couple of different asset classes.
Exactly.
So I think, yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, it's always a mixture of both. I think probably the quickest way to grow would be to just focus on one thing and just go all in on that. But also like with real estate too, like you kind of mentioned, going into the SMB space next is a really good play. And SMB, for anyone listening, stands for just small businesses, is a really good play because while real estate trades at crazy valuations on cash flow, but can appreciate and hold its value really well, SMBs are kind of the opposite in the sense that they'll actually trade for significantly lower levels of cash flow. You know, you can buy, just to use a random example, like a laundromat for $270,000 that makes, you know, $90,000 profit or something like that in a year, right? So it's crazy, crazy low multiples. And the fun part is, especially with real estate, you know, you need cash to continue to play the game. And SMBs are a really great way to kind of produce that cash. Are there specific ones that you're looking at?
No, I just know I want to get into that.
Cool. Okay.
And I agree with what you said. Like, it's easy. It would be better to focus. But like, I was just telling someone this the other day, is I tried to read The One Thing by Gary Keller, I believe.
Yeah,
and I was like a chapter and I was like, nope, this doesn't apply to me.
Yeah. There's
Yeah.
No, I read that book before too. And it's like, he's probably right. Like he's like that probably is the quickest way to go and grow Keller Williams to be like this massive behemoth of a real estate firm. But is it as fun? Like, is are you
gonna listen?
Right. No. Yeah, exactly.
I think in the past week, Connor and I have sent each other probably everything from single family homes, e-commerce stores for sale, you know, SMBs for sale, storage facilities, everything across the sun, which yeah, it focus is definitely needed, but I don't know, it keeps life interesting when you start doing new things.
Yeah. But I also think that there's a lot to be said to have more tools in your toolbox. Cause for me, that's what creative financing is. It's a way to take on deals that other investors can't make a deal out of. So like I buy houses that I wouldn't normally buy with my long-term strategy. So like, yes, that's having two businesses and two strategies, but at the same time, I now have two ways to buy the same deal. So I don't know. There's a fine line.
I think in there is kind of some overlap as well. I think we've used a lot of like the different e-commerce marketing strategies and kind of SEO techniques. And now we apply that to some of the storage facilities we buy. And there are not a lot of other storage owners that can really explain to you how, you know, Google Maps SEO works on the back end with running content and hiring writers, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, we have two deals under contract right now and neither of them have Google listings or websites. So it's just like, you're like, oh, so you're getting 100% of your tenants are people who drive up? Like, okay, like this seems like it might be an opportunity so there.
I do think it gets exciting when you can take, you know, skills you learn in kind of a totally different niche and now you're going to apply it to something else and ideally get some outsized returns there. I want to quickly touch on, what does your current tech stack look like? Because I can sometimes get super nerded out about like, what is everyone using to kind of manage their day-to-day business? Because I don't think there's ever a perfect solution, but it, you know, you get some pretty good tips and tricks there on streamlining operations.
I use TenantCloud for all of my residential, like all my tenants. I use Google Voice, which I'm starting to realize it's kind of a crappy app, but it's really nice because I don't have to give my phone number out to anybody and it's free and I can screen calls. I can send them to voicemail or answer. I also pay like the $10 a month to have the Google Suite. So I have like my Grace at Good Morning Investments Gmail, which I have found goes a long ways in like coming off as professional and like pitching yourself to bankers or private money lenders or whatever. And then I can create emails for like my team members. I use Adobe Sign all the time. I probably don't have a ton of good advice for software and stuff, but I try to keep it simple. I use Calendly. Calendly is huge. What about you guys?
Well, I think it kind of depends. So I think on the storage side, we'll use like easy self-storage solutions, but we're quickly migrating away from that. Gio just found a really cool call center that we're setting up. Yeah, same thing, Google Calendly, all that kind of jazz. I think from a project management standpoint, we use Notion most of the time, which has been pretty helpful.
That's good.
Yeah, it's just very robust. So you can kind of do anything with it, which is nice, which it's a same thing, blessing and a curse, right? It's like sometimes it makes sense to almost like try to fit into one specific type of system.
I think it goes everywhere from, I think we use Notion to manage all of our podcasts and scheduling, everything to then working on banks with financing and organizing contractors on the facility, which again is probably a bit overkill to do all in one platform, but for us
it's one platform.
One platform, a million projects, we can kind of keep it somewhat organized, and then you know, HubSpot on some acquisition stuff and always playing around. But I would say probably Notion is our main. 80% of all our project management and notes gets taken
in. I use Monday sometimes, but I go in and out of that. I'll use it for like a couple months really well, and then I will drop off and then I'll go back to it. So I need to definitely learn that a little bit better and stick to it.
It's so funny that you mention the fact that at like Grace at goodmorninginvestments.com is like, it makes you come off as more professional, solely because like when we were living down in Austin for a little bit, we'd be walking by like this like class A office building in like downtown Austin, and you can tell that it's for sale, or either for sale or for rent. But it's like, to contact and learn more, like email jsmith@aol.com. And you're like, dude, this is a like $20 million building at least. And you were just tossing out like an AOL email address. Like, I was like, zero chance I would trust this. I wonder why it's still for sale.
So funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why it's still for sale.
So personally, I have just one question left that I want to wrap up on. I don't know what Gio has left. But I would say what I want to finish this conversation with is, I feel like a lot of these other podcasts that we'll do, you know, it might seem almost more accessible. Like we'll do like window cleaning podcasts, or like, you know, somebody going out there and like buying vending machines and like building up like a vending machine, right? Like things like that. With real estate, it always just seems a little bit more daunting, just because it just seems like the numbers are just a little bit bigger. And it's like kind of a club that once you're in, you get it. Before you get in, it seems like a whole big daunting world. Is there one or two pieces of advice that you'd give to somebody right now who maybe has like, let's just use a round number, like $30,000-$50,000, something like that in their bank account, saved up on like how they can go and do their first deal, or even just like get their what's a little skin in the game to start investing in real estate?
Yeah, I think that real estate is so scary until you actually sit down and look at a deal and look at the numbers, and then you're like, oh, but it's not that hard. Like when I first had to analyze the 8 unit we bought, I looked at the spreadsheet and I was like, I have no clue what to do. And I just went line by line, and 20 minutes later, I was like, great, I know how to analyze an 8 unit now. Like,
right.
You just have to attack it. If you have $30,000 or $40,000 in your bank account, I think you can absolutely get started in real estate. I know a ton of people who get started with way less. And I would look for a cheap value add property that you can put some sweat equity into. If you're a newbie, start with a cosmetic rehab. Look for that orange shag carpet and the pink painted kitchen and the oak cabinets, and getting something that you can replace flooring, paint, and fixtures goes a long ways, and that'd be a great first deal to start out with.
That's awesome. That's really good advice. That's it on my side. I mean, I don't know. Do you have anything else?
No, I think I'm so intrigued on the creative financing. So as soon as you get that list together of, you know, tips and tricks, we'd love to kind of probably send that out to everyone and maybe even have a whole episode on some of these creative financing things. So I think it makes a huge difference for a lot of people in the beginning and allows for scale and kind of gets rid of some bottlenecks. So I don't think we have too much time to, you know, spend another couple hours chatting on that. Yeah, we really appreciate you coming on, Grace. Before we hop off, where can people follow along and kind of stay up to date on all the projects you're working on?
I think the best way to find me is on Instagram at grace.investing.
Wonderful. We'll attach that in the show notes below. And yeah, thanks again for coming on, Grace.
If you thought today's episode was awesome, we would love it if you would leave a 5-star review on the podcast, either on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It makes a huge difference and lets us get cooler and cooler guests for future episodes.